Okay, so welcome everybody. As you know, I already gave a talk at the conference, and then Christina actually asked me to follow up with some more details, if you wish. Okay, and I decided actually to go one level lower. So in my talk at the conference, I mainly talked about wholesale modeling, and now I go down to the level of molecules in some sense. Okay. So this will be statistical mechanics models for how the force is generated. And this is the kind of information you need to know if you go to cross-grained models like the ones I talked about. So I list actually my two collaborators here. Julian Weichsel was a PhD student with me. He then did his postdoc with Phil Geisler at Berkeley, and he's now back to Germany. And Thorsten Erdmann was also a PhD student of mine and now works with me at Heidelberg. And the two projects I will talk about are mainly with each of those guys. So as a reminder of the talk I gave at the conference, and if you missed it, you can go back to the online recording. Okay, the colors are weird here. Whatever.
You should have assigned everybody to watch the
talk. Yeah.
The German car, right?
So the colors should be completely different, never mind. I mean, actin should be red, for example. So this is the cartoon of a cell. Okay, here's the nucleus. And the cell is attaching to the substrate, and it's generating a lot of force, which you can measure with a technique called traction force microscopy. And this is something we're doing a lot in my group. So we basically get data from experimental groups, and we evaluate the data, and we compare it to models. So what are the force-generating processes? First of all, there is something called the lamellopodium. So this is a rapidly growing gel of a structural protein called actin, which is pushing out the envelope. And in some way, what the cell is doing here, it regrows itself, okay? It's not an elastic problem in the sense that it's a sort of sphere, and it stays a sphere, it's just getting some adhesion energy, just regrowing itself. It forms a completely new structure, basically. And the driving force behind this is this lamellopodium here. So this already creates some force on the substrate, which is a relatively weak force. But later, after typically 15 minutes or so, the cell starts to pull really strongly on the substrate. And then the mechanism is a completely different one. It involves the same structural protein, the actin. But now the main agent here is this myosin 2 molecular motor. And this is exactly what is the basis of our muscle. Okay, but these are not muscle cells. So basically what biology is doing, it uses the same modules over again. So here it's using the apparatus it has for muscle in a different context to create force on a substrate for a non-muscle cell, typically a cell from connective tissue, for example. Okay, so these are two different force-generating processes in the cell. But if you look at the traction force microscopy, I mean, if you measure this on the substrate, you cannot distinguish, okay? You see only one physical force on the substrate. And due to the spatial coordination of the systems, what you typically see is inward-directed forces. So the point I want to repeat here, which I made in the conference also, is that, I mean, the myosins pull inward anyway, so this gives you an inward force. But also the actin polymerization is at the very edge of the cell. It's basically a pushing process. It pushes against the membrane, but it's pushed away. I mean, the membrane is pushing back, and it's actually pushing on the adhesion sites, which are a little bit farther inside the cell body, and therefore you also get an inward force from this process, okay? So you you really never really observe outward forces in this kind of experiments, okay? It's always inward forces, despite the fact that they come from very different processes, okay? It's just the spatial coordination as such. Okay, now to put this into a very simple picture, we come up with this spring diagram here. So I take this from the review I wrote with Sam Seffrin, and which contains many other information, so I advertise it here. So basically, what you have is this polymerizing actin gels, which act like a pushing force, but it's pushing actually from the edge towards the interior, so it gives you an inward force here. Then you have these contractile elements here, which is like a tensed spring in the middle. And together, this gives you these inward forces. And because these kind of cells typically polarize, so they actually build all the machinery in one direction, it's an anisotropic force contraction dipole. Okay? So this is a concept we introduced a long time ago, 15 years ago. So, and this is a very helpful concept if you look at cross-grained models. Okay? But of course, today I would like to discuss the underlying mechanisms, and then we have to go down in scale. And we have to really talk about the molecules which are doing this. Okay, so these are the kind of coarse-grained models. You can make a sort of mechanistic model of polymers contracted by myosin motors. This is what Fred McIntosh talked about in his talk. A model class we actually like to work with is active cable networks. It's a, if you wish, very abstracted form of these polymer networks. Then the contour models is the simplest thing to say. You only go for the geometry. You say how much area, how much periphery do I have. Active gels model, this is what Jean-Francois Choigny talked about and what also Christina worked on a lot. Active elasticity is basically the same idea that you put in some conductivity in the system, but not in the context of fluids, but in the context of solids. So I call it active elasticity. And again, both Christina and we have been working on this. And then there are other models like the cellular pots model, which is a well-known model in the field of tissue dynamics, but which you also can apply to cells if you wish. Or phase field or level set models, for example, Igor Aronson works a lot with this recently to model cell migration. Okay? And I think you can actually make this list even longer. So there are all these kind of coarse-grained models for how cells generate forces, how they move, how they react to the environment, but all of them rely on some information on the level below, okay? And this is what I would like to address today. So this is a more molecular view on what's going on. So this is what a biologist is doing, okay? He draws this very complex scheme of how the different molecules work together. This is from Laurent Planchois from Grenoble and colleagues. And you basically see the same elements which I show you in my physicist cartoon, okay? But now in a very different way. So this here is the lamellipodium. I mean, it's a cell which is polarized, it's crawling in this direction. This is the lamellipodium where all this polymerization goes on. So here you see how the polymerization looks in detail, and we'll come back to this later. Then these are these contractile elements, the so-called stress fibers. And if you look here, for example, you see the myosin motors which are pulling the actin together. And I'll also come back to this in the second part of my talk. So this is the molecular basis, and we need to know about all these molecules to understand the biology of this. Now, there's one interesting aspect which at first glance looks like biochemistry, okay? So these guys have actually found that there are two different proteins which regulate very strongly how this works. But if you think a little bit about this, this is really a very nice way to actually enter biophysics door into this problem, okay? So what they found is actually that there's one protein which, if you actually increase its level in the cell will look like this. It's basically having a lot of protrusive activity at the edge, only small adhesions. So what's basically doing is polymerizing lots and lots of these actin networks here, okay? But then if you go to another protein and you increase the level of that one, it's an antagonistic protein, you basically get lots of these contractile stress fibers and you get very large adhesions, okay? And you also see that it's very much polarized now, okay? And this is the other mechanism I talked about. So biology basically has this antagonistic system where you have two main phenotypes, if you wish, okay? So many people say this is completely exaggerated, you upregulate one protein, and this is not very physiological. But for me as a physicist, it's nice to see that there are these two extreme cases, okay? The strongly protruding one and the strongly contracting one. And it reminds me of the microswimmers, okay? Because in the microswimmers, we have this classification of pullers and pushers, and it's the same thing here, okay? So for me, these are the pushers, and these are the pullers, basically. So this is a nice way to structure the whole thing, and I would like to discuss each of these cases one after the other. So let's start with the pushing case. So this is about the actin polymerization, and we developed a relatively transparent STATMEC model in a PNAS paper. So again, this was a PhD student of mine, and we wrote some more papers, and I would like to point to this one in PRE, where we actually showed that our results are much more general than we believed in the studying stage. And I will explain this. So again, some biology to start with as a motivation. So here you see a fast-moving cell. It's a keratinocyte, and it's using this polymerizing actin gels to push itself forward. On the right-hand side, you see the underlying mechanism. It's this jungle of actin filaments. This is a microscopic microscope image. And in fact, this is the only technique to really see the single filaments. Okay, I mean, in fluorescence, the resolution is not good enough. So to see really how what is underlying this, you need to do the electron microscopy, and I come back to this later. So basically, this is the cell, and this is some inset here. And if you go to the very edge, this is the dynamic region where everything grows all the time. So this is, again, a molecular view from a famous review by Gary Borisi and Tom Pollard. And you basically see a cycle here, okay? So you actually grow these networks. The networks push themselves away from the front, okay? They're degraded. You actually decompose them into these monomers. The monomers somehow stream back and they're incorporated again. So it's a recycling.
I'm just wondering why that image looks so different than the one you showed before, the fibrocytes. the front is really smooth. Does it not have the same focal adhesions and pore aspect? Because its front is very smooth, where the other ones have a little.
You mean the other cartoon I showed you? Well, the keratocytes, yeah, there are two biology cartoons. Yeah, the one was a migrating fibroblast, which has a strong contractile component. And the other one was the keratocyte, which is an extremely fast-moving cell. It's living on the skin of fish. It doesn't have much obstacles, actually. It just runs very quickly. While the fibroblast is living in our connective tissue, and it has another function. It has to actually draw together wounds and restructure the collagen, so it's a very different cell type.
But so does that explain why the front is so smooth in one of them?
No, it doesn't explain it, but these cells have relatively little adhesions, so okay, this makes a main difference. And if you put them on a strongly adhesive substrate, which is done by Juliette Perriot at Stanford, they somehow change into fibroblast-like morphology, okay? Which is very nice from a modeling point of view, because it shows that the adhesion is the main, might be one of the main handles. But there are also other differences, okay? It's a different cell type. Okay, so the point is that you need some kind of recycling, okay? So what I'm focusing on is the leading edge here. I would like to talk about a model to explain what is going on here at the leading edge. But you should think also in the back of your mind about this whole system thing, okay? It always has to replenish stuff, so it brings back the stuff from behind to the front. So let's start with the physics part, okay? So the idea is that we actually identify the most important processes here, and there are basically four important processes. So this is the leading edge. The network is growing against it. So it has a certain growth rate or growth velocity of each single filament. It incorporates new monomers. And this depends on the actin concentration and a few other things. But basically, we assume that it's a constant. Okay, so there's a certain constant rate with which the actin filament grows. Then it actually, the whole network has to be in a spatially extended structure. Okay, so the way the system is doing it, it's branching. It branches off daughter filaments to all sides, and this way it actually is able to fill out space. Okay, there's another process which I don't consider here, which is cross-linking, because if you only look at this, oops, what is this? Okay, so if you only look at the branching, you get many trees. Okay, I mean many interdigitated trees. There's another process, cross-linking, which connects these trees to each other. But let's for the moment actually ignore this. Now, one problem you have is if you just branch and grow, you will get very long filaments, okay? And this is bad for the mechanical stability of the system. I mean, after all, this is a mechanical device. It's growing against the membrane. So there's another intriguing aspect. There's a capping protein which actually caps these after a certain while. There's a typical rate for this. And this keeps the filaments short. So the main process is branching, okay? And the system always has only relatively short filaments which do not buckle if you push on them or which only bend a little bit. And this way it's a very mechanically stable system. And then of course you have this constant incorporation of new monomers. The whole thing is growing out. So basically there's this outgrowth. I mean, if there's a new branch here, you will lose it after some time because it's pushed away from the membrane. It's called retrograde flow, okay? So the thing always disappears in the bottom part and appears with new material at the front part. So when we looked at this, we actually realized that there are some little details which matter, okay? I mean, if you write down kinetic equations for this, it really matters which kind of reaction terms you use, okay? So we realized that the order of these different reactions is very important. So for the capping, we just assume, like it's generally believed, that it's a first order reaction because the capping protein is usually present in excess. Okay, so each free end will find some capping protein at some point. But for the branching, this is less clear. Okay, so the details of the branching process are under a lot of debate, basically. And there are two extreme cases. So one case would be that the branching agent is there in excess, which means that if I put in a new filament, it will be able to branch because there's always enough branching agent, okay? This is what we call the autocatalytic regime, where basically the system would explode and grow a lot of new branches, okay, because there are this many branching agents. And the alternative would be the zero order regime, where you have a limited amount of branching agents. So if I put in more actin filaments, it cannot branch because there's only a limited reservoir of new branches, okay? So there would be just a constant number of branches, irrespective of how many filaments I have in my reaction volume, okay? So these are the two extreme cases.
You hold over the membrane, and I'm always puzzled. There are some fluctuations in the membrane, yeah. And then the monomer can come in and...
Yeah, this is the so-called, this problem has been addressed by Alex Mugilner a long time ago. And they have this Brownian redshift model, where the membrane fluctuates up, there's an exponential probability to get in. And this is sort of the accepted viewpoint, so I think there's nothing wrong with it. We don't need it here. Okay. But it's another aspect of the system.
Yeah.
Okay. So I come back to this rule. So, exactly of this question which was just asked. It's not clear how the velocity is actually determined in the system. Okay. So we make an assumption that the velocity is determined by a simple rule which we don't model in detail. Okay. I come back to this. Okay. So let me start with this kinetic model. So we now write down equations for these different players. So we introduce the number of these branching agents. They are bound, not bound, activated, not activated. So we just take this very simple view that basically we monitor the number of bound but not branched branching agents, they're called R2-3. And we model the number of nucleation promoting factors. These are the factors that actually activate the branching. Okay. So here we have a filament, the R2-3 binds, an activator comes, activates it, it is branching. Okay. This is sort of the standard view on this. And if you actually solve the system for steady state, what you see is that the branching rate, so the branching rate is basically this term here, okay? So the branching rate as a function of filament number has this form, okay? And this defines the two regimes I've been talking about. So there's one regime, as you increase the number of actin filaments, you get more branching. That's the autocatalytic regime. This should be red. And if you, so I think the red is not working here, okay? And if you go to the high number, you go to a very high number of actin filament numbers, you get this this plateau. So the idea is that the network in the beginning, if there's very little actin, it will rapidly grow, okay? But it would explode, so it has to turn over another regime where the capping protein is the limiting factor, and it then grows at a steady state, okay? I think it's a very clever device to do it this way. And we think that this is what's happening here, basically. Okay, so let's show you a computer simulation. It's a very simple two-dimensional computer simulation. We just implement all the rules I gave you. We start with a network which is growing very quickly. So one is actually the maximal velocity here. So we are very close to the maximal velocity. And as you see, most filaments are actually in the direction of growth. Okay, there's branching, but in principle, it's just going up. Now, actually, we actually changed one parameter here. This is the number of filaments we stall at the very front, so we increase that. The velocity goes down, and then the network reorganizes, and now we did it for a second time, and it reorganizes again, okay? So what we actually see is, as we change the network velocity, we see a huge restructuring in the network, okay? So let me show you some snapshots here. So this is fast growth, intermediate growth, slow growth, and you see that something is different, okay? So what we now do is we look at the histogram of the orientation distribution, and you see it's completely different. So in this case, most of the filaments point in the zero direction, okay? In this case, what you have is actually that they form a crisscross pattern, okay? like this, and they point basically in plus minus 35 degrees. Now, one thing I haven't mentioned yet is that the branching angle is exactly 17. Okay, it depends a little bit on the species you're talking about. There's a certain variability, and we take actually a Gaussian distribution around it, but the average is 17. Okay, so what is happening here is that if a filament is growing in this direction, and it's branching off, it will branch in this direction. But the nice thing, it stabilizes each other, okay? Then it branches back to the other side, and you stabilize the other side, okay? So they actually reinforce each other, and this is why it's such a stable structure, okay? But it only occurs at intermediate growth velocity, and if you go to slow growth velocity, you're back to a structure which has many filaments in the forward direction, but also a considerable amount of filaments at plus minus 70, okay? So if you make a cartoon of this,
what size is that 70 angle in reality?
Pardon?
The 70 degree angle.
Yeah, it's very well established.
Micrograph, what's the distribution?
Hmm?
If you measure that 70 degree angle in a micrograph, is it like 65 to 75?
It has a variance of 5. It's very, very well established. So it doesn't matter for our theory because we are completely independent of this angle as long as we don't go beyond 90, okay? But if you look at the literature, it's between 65 and 75, and for the average, and then there's a variance of 500. So it's a very evolutionary, it's an extremely important complex, the UP2-3 complex, and it's very well conserved. The reason is that actin is so much conserved, and it works on actin. Okay, so the binding sites to actin, and it actually contains two actin, sort of actin molecules inside. Okay. So this is the reason why it's always the same. It cannot change in evolution because actin was invented so early. Anyway, so what you see is this very clear scheme. So you either have a structure where you have something growing in the forward direction, plus minus 70 at the sides, okay, or you have something which is plus minus 35. And these two structures are similar, but in detail a little bit different. I mean, this has much more side lobes. Now, the mechanism behind this is also very simple to understand, okay? So what we're having here is the following. You start with a network growth velocity, okay, which I call VNW for network. And now you have the growth velocity of a given filament, okay? And it's clear that the network growth velocity has to be smaller or equal to the growth velocity of the single filament. I mean, this is the speed limit. It cannot grow faster, okay? So this vector here has to be a little bit smaller than the vector which comes from the growth of a single actin filament, okay? But the actin filament can go in different directions. So if it goes in this region here, it's basically faster. If you project it onto the forward direction, it's faster, so it can grow with the network. If it's pointing too much to the side, its projection is too small and it's lost from the network, okay? So we represent this by this little formula. We say the outgrowth rate is zero if it's above the critical angle, so it can grow with the network, it's not lost. But if it's actually pointing too much to the side, it will be lost from the system and go away. And in this way, you see how the network growth velocity is regulating the system, okay? So if I change this vector here, if I make it smaller, I actually increase the size of the region where the network can grow with me. So if I make the network very slow, these side lobes here can keep up. Okay. If I make it very fast, they cannot keep up, and I only can grow in the forward direction. And this is a compromise in between. Okay. It's a very simple idea, but I think it's beautiful. Okay. It's a very, very nice scheme how it might work actually. And just from the fact that you have branching. Okay. This is the main ingredient here. So now comes the more mathematical part, but I'm very short on this. So basically, rather than doing this complicated computer simulation, you can come up with a simple equation, okay? So you basically write down the population of filaments at a given time to point in a certain direction. And you have three gain and loss terms. So you actually gain from branching, but branching has a kernel which brings you by 70 degree from another position, okay? So we integrate over all other positions. And you basically have this branching of 70 degree in here. So this is the W is basically a Gaussian kernel with 70 degrees in it. Then the capping, I already explained, we assume that it's a first order reaction. So it's just linear in the number of filaments. But the branching, we are actually more careful what we do here. So if I do it this way, you see that the N is normalized and it's a zero order reaction. Okay? But I could, we also put in other laws here, and I come back to this later. So this is the zero order case. And finally, we have the outgrowth, which I just showed you. This means that you're constantly losing, okay? And you're losing, of course, those which are pointing very much away. They cannot keep up, and these are the ones you're losing.
Is the recycling and diffusion of monomers not important?
Yes, of course, but it's implicitly in here. I mean,
I was just wondering, so I've seen at least half a dozen talks on these sorts of models, and I don't know what's the same and different among them. Can you place your models when you're
Well, first of all, I mean, you see, this is the only model which addresses the bistability between two different structures. I mean, this is the only model of this kind to start with. I mean, Antonio can correct me because he also works on this, and they worked on a model which looked at the sort of the steady state characteristics, okay? But I mean, our model is the one which pointed out this competition between the two different states. And we don't really focus on the mechanical part of it, which is the main focus of many other models, okay? And we don't focus on the sort of diffusion part of it.
And so we're pretty sure that that's not important. Like, do we know this bistability exists?
Hey, come on, it's biology, okay? Everything is important. It depends on the questions you are asking.
Confused, that's all, right?
No, you shouldn't be confused. The point is that we are focusing here on the fact that there are structural transitions in the network, and I show the evidence for it later.
Do you have in mind that some of these parameters will be educated by experiments? Or?
Yeah. So in the supplement, we put in all the numbers, and the way we do it, it makes sense. But it's a very generic model. Okay. It doesn't depend much on any detailed assumptions, except the order of the branching, and this is something nobody really measured until now. So we would actually love to have somebody measuring this in an in vitro assay, but it's very difficult. But basically, you have to tag fluorescently the capping proteins and to really measure how many of them are there. And that's I only know one paper which tried to do that. That's very complicated. So I think what's happening, I mean, as I already explained, there's only one technique in which you can really see the structure of the network, and that's electron microscopy, okay? And electron microscopy will improve a lot during the next year because this is what experts tell me. There's a new type of detector out there, and you will get much better data in a year from now, okay? And this will hopefully make a big change for the actin networks too. So until now, there are a few very nice structural studies, but they're not conclusive in this aspect. Okay. So coming back to the model.
Can you, about this, can you maybe, a couple of years ago, there was at some point rumors or people saying that branching did not.
Yeah, so I come back to it. We actually were part of this story at a certain extent. So I explain it when I come to the electron microscopy. OK, but now the model first, OK? So basically, the model incorporates the simple ideas, OK? And you can now numerically solve this model. And if you do it, you get these solid lines here, okay? So you get exactly the kind of orientation histograms which we have seen in the computer simulation. Also, this is a simple rate equation approach, okay? It nicely fits in. But what is even nicer is you can now, once you understand that you have these very prominent peaks, you actually reduce the theory to these peaks, okay? So what you do is you integrate out all the angles around a certain prominent direction, and you just end up with five different directions, okay? You only take 0, 35, and 70. It's actually only three directions because this is a metric, okay? So we have basically a simple rate equation ODE model with only three parameters, only three variables and very few parameters, okay? And if you now look at this, you actually can do the steady state and linear stability analysis. It turns out it has an extremely simple phase diagram, which I show you. And it has histograms, which are basically this bars here, okay? And it also fits perfectly. So it all fits together nicely. So let's look at the phase diagram. The full model where we actually numerically propagate the rate equation would give you something like this. So there are three parameters here, the capping rate, the branching rate, and the network growth speed. And you see that only one of these is important. I mean, only the growth velocity gives you a structural transition here. On the right-hand side, you see our simple model where we only use this effectively three variables. It has a problem here at large capping rate because you disregard actually the angles which are larger than 90 But in principle, it gives you the same picture. Okay? It identifies the one really important variable in the system, which is the network growth velocity. And we even showed in this PRE that this doesn't depend on the order of the reaction. Okay? So we actually, so what we do is we look at zero order branching. This is this picture. Okay? Then we slowly go from zero to first order branching. And what happens is that basically the whole results stay the same, except that the case of the autocatalytic growth, the first order branching, it's sort of a singular a limit, if you wish, because something strange happens there. Okay, you have to fulfill some additional algebraic relationships, but it doesn't mean a discontinuity in the phase diagram. Okay, the phase diagram stays the same. So this is a very nice result. Okay, so we showed that it's independent of the order of branching.
Olga? Where do you put in this information about the 35 and 70 degrees? Is this in the full model? This function W, which you have there in this curve?
So it's basically just how we call these variables. I mean, if it was 40, we would call this 40.
No. In the full model.
In the full model? Oh, this is in this W here. Yeah. That's the kernel of the convolution.
It's specially designed, so to speak.
Yeah. Mm. But as I said, it doesn't really matter. It's independent of this number. Okay, just briefly, we can also calculate a force-velocity relationship. I don't go into the details. It's not a mechanical model in the strict sense, okay? We don't talk about semi-flexible polymers and so on, just in a very simple manner. But the nice thing is that you actually get something which comes from the fact that two different structures compete with each other, so you get bistability in a hysteresis loop, okay? And this has been observed in experiments. So this was the first paper which actually explained the hysteresis loop. Okay, I wouldn't say that today we would actually give exactly the same explanation, but it was the first one which had this had a mechanism for it. Okay, you also see that the force-velocity relationship is relatively rich, so it has a convex part, it has a relatively weakly dependent part, and it has this sudden drop here, and this is what actually is generally believed to be true. So what is generally believed to be true, and it also came out in your work, that there is a relatively long stretch where it's relatively flat and there's an abrupt, breakdown of the system, okay? And it has been measured with AFM on cells and things like this, so it's a result which most people believe in, okay? And this is the right part of it. But in addition, we have this hysteresis here. Now let's come to the electron microscopy. So as I said, this is the only way to actually look at these actin networks in detail. So we teamed up with Vic Small from Jena, and we asked him for his micrographs, okay? And like Antonio asked for this, so there has been some confusion. So basically, Vic Small published a paper in Nature Cell Biology where he said that branching is not very frequent, and that the actin filaments tend to be much longer than usually assumed, okay, and that maybe cross-linking is a more important aspect. But then there was a debate about this data, and somebody reanalyzed the data. This was Tatjana Switkinar, and she showed that even in this data there is a lot of branching. Okay, so I think the debate is settled, and it's clear that branching is very important. You find it in Vic Small's data as well, and I will show you in a minute this is also true for what we did. But Vic Small, of course, was right to point out that the network is very variable, and that sometimes it has very long stretches, it has more crosslinks and so on. It's a very variable system, okay? I mean, this is a generic theory. So let me show what we did. We basically got this kind of data from Vic Small. So these are keratocytes, and we actually look at the movies and we say which is a fast-moving cell and which is a slow-moving cell. Okay, you see in the movie that some are fast and some are slow. Then Vic Small and his collaborators, they actually freeze in the system, they do cryo-EM, and what they get is this kind of data for a lamellar podium. So what you see here, what is this playing? Is stacking through the frozen sample, and you see very nicely the actin filaments, you see beautifully the monomeric structure, you see how they're all parallel to the glass plate, okay, which validates the two-dimensional approach, and you see that they have very clear orientations. Okay, so what we then do is we actually go to the middle of the stack, where we have the beautiful arrangement of the actin filaments, and we do image processing. So we actually binarize the system. We write a MATLAB script which actually draws out all the skeletons, and we make straight filaments out of this. And in the end, we are able to actually draw a extracted skeleton, a network, on top of this data. Where does it stop? Okay, anyway. So in the end, what we can do is we can calculate a orientation distribution histogram, okay? The same like we did in the theory. So this is the color again is wrong here. This is the color code of the orientations, and this is the final result. So what you see is that if you look at a fast moving keratocyte, we see that it actually has exactly this plus minus 35. I mean, this is Richard where now the variance comes in, okay? So you see it's not perfect, but you see very nicely the two peaks, okay? So this is very, and you also know from all the structural biology that the up to 3 makes the 70, okay? So it fits very nicely. So there's a 70 here between the two peaks. But if you look at a slow moving cell, you see that the orientation distribution histogram is completely different, okay? So the way we interpret this.
So asymmetric?
Pardon?
So asymmetric?
Yeah, we don't know. And this is just the other side we got. I mean, the point is that we basically analyzed like 5 data sets, okay? And each of them have a small size. A few hundred filaments or maybe 1,000 if it's, but you have to see the kind of statistic we have, okay? But it's very clear that it is not this structure here, okay? And we have, so we have for each of these cases, we have like 3 data sets to show that it's really different.
You can't tell plus from minus in here, right? So you assume that
what do you mean?
In your micrographs, yeah. In these pictures.
You see, the point is this is the leading edge, okay? And all the actin filaments grow with their plus end towards the leading edge. So they are all oriented in this direction. And then it's plus minus regarding the normal. But there's no, I mean, the symmetry is there, so nothing wrong with that. Okay, so in our model, we interpret it like this. If we actually have a fast moving cell, we think that we are in this phase here. And this is why we should get the two peaks. And if we have a slow moving cell, where the side lobes can keep up with the network, we should expect some prominent peak in the middle, okay? So this is the best you can get, okay? So we basically compare these histograms here, these two, with these, okay? And this is the path we can get in our interpretation. So we believe the agreement is in the fact that we have clearly plus minus 35 for the fast-moving cells and the prominent peak at 0 for the slow-moving cells, okay? So this was the first part of my talk, and now I come to the second part, which is about pulling. I should also mention that, of course, to put the network growth model into context, you should now include mechanics and attachment to the substrate, and this is done by many different groups, okay? It's a big field. So as you asked before, I mean, our model was meant to look at the biostability, to show that there are these different networks, that we can induce structural transitions by changing the velocity, and this is, I think, what the electron microscopy data confirmed.
So am I understanding well that essentially you're missing the side branching
yes.
piece of the slow one, yeah. and there must be some other mechanism that may be capping them or whatever early?
Yeah, who knows? I mean, the first thing we would love to see is some measurement of the concentration of the capping proteins, okay? And then, of course, I mean, the activation of the branching agent is a very complex biochemical network, okay? There's a certain uncertainty what happens exactly. It might be very local. It is very local, okay? So you could easily imagine that, I mean, along the network there are actually changes. And also it's known that these systems are actually oscillatory, okay? So you typically have a period of fast expansion, then some standstill, maybe some retraction. So there is a oscillation behind it, and this is pretty unclear what exactly is oscillating here, okay? So there's a lot of room for additional work in this field. Okay, pulling. So now we go away from the polymerization and we go to molecular motors. Okay. In principle, it's a completely different system, except that it uses the same actin filaments. But as I said before, actin filaments are very ubiquitous. Okay, they're everywhere. They're one of the oldest parts of biology. So what is different is now the protein which works here, and this is the myosin II motor. This is exactly what creates force in our muscle. Now, in muscle, it actually assembles into something which is called a sick filament. It's a huge protein complex with 300 of, actually, in each half sarcomere, 300 of heads or something like this. I mean, it's just huge, okay? And the reason is it wants to be extremely deterministic. It wants to be very strong. It needs as many motors in parallel as possible to create a very large force, okay? Now, in the cytoskeleton, what we talk about, it's very different. It's a much more disorganized system. It doesn't need to create very large forces in a very organized manner, but it has to create a lot of small forces where it needs it, okay, in a very dynamic context, okay? So the system is restructured. It now uses small filaments, which are called minifilaments, working in groups of 10 to 30. And many of the reconstitution assays we heard about at the conference, they use these minifilaments, okay? And one problem with the minifilaments is, as far as I understand it, that nobody really knows exactly their size, okay? I mean, this is anecdotal evidence. This is an electron, a frozen sample, and you look and you try to count how many heads are here, okay? If you do ultracentrifugation or whatever, I mean, the kind of techniques you have to measure sizes of complexes is on, you get a relatively broad distribution. And it depends a lot on the conditions, the pH and stuff like this, okay? So I would say that we are completely in the dark about the real distribution of these myosin miller filaments. It's a big issue. So, I mean, what you really have to do is you have to go through different sizes, different variants of these to see the biological relevance of it, okay? It depends on the details, and you will see a little bit more details. Just to give you a beautiful image from a paper which I like a lot. As I said, most evidence comes from electron microscopy, but there's now this new technique of super-resolution microscopy, okay? And with the super-resolution, you start to see single actin filaments. So this is a work by Harvard where they actually image the actin both at the dorsal and at the ventral side, okay? So if you look at the dorsal side first, so this is the upper part of the cell, you see the actin network, you see that it looks a little bit like I showed you before, okay? It's actually a little bit different because the laminal podium is here and this is already the cortex. But in principle, it's a similar structure and you see that it's relatively homogeneous. Now, if you go to the dorsal side, okay, if you image here, look what you see, okay? It's completely different. So the network is interdispersed with these contractile elements, and these are the so-called stress fibers. And the stress fibers are mainly originating from the action of myosin II motor activity. Not all of them, but most of them, okay? So you see the big difference between having a contracted network and having an isotropic network. And then if you actually add something which inhibits the motor, the lower network becomes homogeneous. I think this is beautiful, okay? I mean, it's a real proof that the myosin motor activity is the main agent to actually contract this network, okay? So this just pinpoints the fact that the myosin is the important element here. Okay, so this is work by Margaret Gardell from Chicago, which is really very impressive and which is a nice physics work. So basically what they looked at is what I just mentioned. They systematically went through all kinds of minifilaments. I mean, they changed their size, they changed their character, taking them from this cell type or this cell type, okay? And what they found is a very clear physics picture, okay? So the first thing they noted is that the unloaded velocity, I mean, the contraction velocity depends on the length of the bundle, okay? Like in muscle. I mean, the longer the thing, because it contracts everywhere with the same velocity, the faster the overall contraction. The second thing they noted is that the maximal tension does not depend on length, okay? So a longer bundle is not a stronger bundle, okay? And the reason is that it's a serial arrangement. So it's like here, it's like a sarcomeric structure. If you add one of the sarcomeres, it doesn't change anything in the force, okay? Because it's a one-dimensional system. And this is what this data tells you. And finally, if you increase the number of heads in a minifilament, this is like, I mean, changing the force in a single sarcomere, then the tension actually scales, okay? And this together shows you immediately that you have something like a sarcomeric structure. Now in the experiment, you don't see a sarcomeric structure. I mean, they do mainly optical microscopy. You don't really see a sarcomeric structure, but this force data suggests that there must be something like a sarcomeric structure. Okay, so what is the mechanism in detail? You have this myosin motor. It is attached at one side with an elastic element to another surface, and on the other side it binds to the substrate, okay? And then it's doing this famous power stroke, okay? And this is the way it creates force. So basically it's an elastic process where something, a cantilever is switched from one side to the other, and it uses ATP to do this. The so-called cross-bridge cycle in principle looks like this. You start with the unattached part, you attach to the substrate, you do the power stroke. This is where you actually tense the spring here. Then there's ATP release. So this could be red ATP. If you have ATP available, you now unbind, okay? If you are dead, there's no ATP. You don't unbind. Therefore, you are stuck in this state. This is called a Reiger state because your muscle is completely cross-linked and you are stiff like bone or stone, okay? Only if you have ATP in a living system, you can go back, okay? You hydrolyze it, you have the recovery stroke, and the cycle is closed. So this is the basic idea of the cross-bridge cycle, and the Nobel Prize was awarded for this. Now, if you do modeling, you can actually focus on different aspects of this, okay? So for example, Tom Duke did beautiful work. This was published in a single author paper in PNAS 1999, where he focused on these three states, okay? So basically he takes one reaction rate for this whole part here, and he just has a triangle, okay? So there's another work, for example, by Sam Walcott and co-workers 2 years ago, where they actually focused on another aspect of the system. They especially looked at the ATP concentration dependence. Then you need to put focus on these points, and therefore they took 4 states, okay? And you can come up with models with even more states, okay? So it depends on the aspect you would like to model. So what we did is actually we went back to Tom Duke's model and we used the three-state model, okay? But the difference is that we now actually look at small ensemble of motors. So what we have in mind is something like you see here. These are 6 motors which all work in parallel. And we would like to understand how they work against some external force, either some constant force or some linearly increasing force, okay? But the focus of our work is on a small number of motors. And the reason is that in the minifilaments in the cytoskeleton, there is a small number, okay? I showed you 10 to 30 is the accepted number, okay? So Tom Duke looked at 300 because he looked at muscle, and we now look at the cytoskeleton. So this is the cycle I showed you. For each single motor, you have such a cycle, and there are some rates attached to it. But the important point is that if you now look at, let's call it anti-motors, you build up a large reaction network, okay? Because what you have is basically 2 reaction coordinates. So this is the number of attached motors. So if I have, let's say, okay, wait a second. 1, 2, 3, 4. So let's put NT equals 4. I can have up to 4 motors being attached to the substrate. On each of these motors can be before and after the power stroke. Okay. So this gives you the 2 reaction coordinates, and the whole thing is a triangle. And then you know all the reaction rates in between, and this is always the step where you actually unbind. This is the irreversible step. This is also related to ATP hydrolysis. Okay. So this is the reaction network we look at. Now the problem is there's no way you can solve this analytically, okay? So you basically can do a computer simulation on this network, but as far as I know, you cannot solve the triangular master equation this way. So what we did is actually came up with the following idea. So we basically looked at this network and we realized that the transitions in this direction, they're supposed to be the fast transitions, okay? And the transitions in this direction, they are supposed to be the slow ones. So these are the binding-unbinding, and this is the power stroke direction. So what we did is we took the assumption of local thermal equilibrium along this direction. We integrate out this direction, and we project the whole thing onto a one-dimensional master equation. Okay? And now you won because this is exactly solvable. That's simple, okay? That's in the books. So let me just mention that we used the one-step master equation for other purposes before. So for example, we worked on the stability of Cartesian clusters under force, and we used also the one-step master equation. Or there's this beautiful paper by Stefan Klump and Reinhard Lepofsky where they looked at transport by multiple motors, And they also use this one-set master equation.
So by one set, do you mean Markov?
Yeah, well, Markov anyway. I mean, even the two-dimensional network would be a Markov model, of course. I mean, we always do master equations with Markov properties. No, one step means that it's a one-dimensional system.
Oh.
So you only have two neighbors. Okay. So let's say if you have I modulus bound, you can either unbound one of them, you go down to I minus one, or you bind another one and you go to I plus one. And then the boundaries here are different. So this is basically a reflecting boundary. So if you come to a fully occupied system, you just can go back, okay? And this is an absorbing boundary because if you unbound all the motors, the system is dead because you lost connection, okay? So there's a strong asymmetry between the two boundaries here. But both are natural boundaries in the language of stochastic dynamics. Okay, so this is the bit where we integrate out. So we basically write down partial partition sums. here's where all the known molecular details go into it. I mean, how much energy do you need to make a power stroke? What is the force dependence of the rates? So I just would like to point out that, it's not in here. But it must be somewhere, wait a second. Here. So there's one rate here which depends on force, okay? So if you unbind, this is where I need the ATP. It has been shown that you actually need if you increase the force on the system, so if you stress it somehow, then this unbinding is slower, okay? And this is called a catch bond behavior, okay? And the catch bond stuff was rediscovered for adhesion receptors like the selectin system, but for experts in the muscle field, it was always clear that this exists because the myosin II is a catch bond, okay? Just nobody called it this way, I guess. But the myosin II is a bond which actually becomes stronger under force. And this is very important for the functioning of muscle. Okay, so let me show you some computer simulations. So one thing I didn't explain yet is that the way we do this model, we don't have any spatial coordinate. Okay, it's really the binding dynamics of the motors. So if we want to now relate this to movement, we have to come up with a concept how we include space. And we do this in a very simple-minded manner with slave space. I mean, if you know the reactions, we know how the thing is actually propagating in space. And we just give rules. I mean, if one motor unbinds, how much does it move? Depending on all the other parameters, if one motor binds, what is happening? So these are relatively straightforward rules, okay? So in this way, we can include space into the system. And now the whole ensemble is able to move stuff, okay? So for example, if you have a constant force, it moves basically with a steady speed until at some point there's a catastrophe. Okay, the catastrophe is, you see it down here, if all the motors simultaneously unbind. Okay, so during this movement, you all the time have unbinding, binding, unbinding, unbinding. So these are eight motors and it fluctuates around three or four here. Okay, this is the stochastic dynamics behind it. But then there's also a finite probability for a first passage to zero. And you get into the absorbed state, okay? You completely lose connection, and the system is basically free, okay? The two surfaces are not connected with each other. And then you have to include a new rule. So we basically say that there is there's still this force acting, okay? We say that the upper surface is drawn back with a certain mobility, so we put in some viscosity here, and then there's a certain probability to bind again, and then it starts again, okay? I mean, this is something we said.
So I miss if now that you're putting space, are you correlating in any way the statistics of these, or somehow, I mean, the fact that one unbinds, is it correlated to the next one?
Yeah, of course, through the backbone.
So this is in this rule.
Okay, these are the rules. So you have this force-dependent rule here, and the force you have to calculate from the whole ensemble. So basically, the stiff backbone propagates information to the other modules.
Right,
so it's a, yeah, this is the whole point of the model. It's a coupled model, okay? They're all coupled.
Has anybody done the experiment on the single motor and then saw the catchy bone?
Yes.
How big the force you can reduce?
Ah, this is the typical stall force is 5 piconewtons.
But supposing you increase the force of like 10 or 20 piconewtons, it really unbinds, right?
This I'm not sure about, okay? So first of all, the person who did this experiment is Claudia Weigel, when she was in England, but now she's in Munich. And she's using the so-called three-bit assay, which was pioneered by James Buttigieg here at the West Coast. And they even see some substructure. So it's not only a single power stroke, okay, there's a small step in between and so on. I'm not sure about the forces. I mean, one thing I would like to point out is the following. I mean, you have this motor sitting here, okay? And force is a vector, okay? You can pull in many different directions, okay? So, I mean, there are directions, when you pull it off, it's like a slip bond, because it's just some binding interface, okay? But there's one direction, which is the direction in which it usually works in the physiological environment, okay? So in the muscle, it's extremely well arranged, and there, I'm assuming there's only one direction where it can work, okay? In the cytoskeleton, I think it's pretty unclear in which direction it will work. Okay, because, I mean, the fibers might be a little bit like this, okay? There might be another minifilament close by distorting the whole system. I don't know. I mean, it will be a very disordered system. So I wouldn't be sure that the force is always acting in the same direction in the same manner, okay? And I'm sure this adds a lot of variability to the cytoskeletal system that you don't see in muscle. But this is, I think, very much unexplored, okay? So there was a paper in PNAS where they showed that they can rip off in different directions, and they see the slip bond behavior in one direction and the catch bond in the other, something like this. I don't remember quite well, but I mean, there must be this kind of aspect to it. So I think it's a very difficult challenge to do the force spectroscopy on this kind of motors, because you have to make a decision how to pull on it, okay? I mean, you also work on force spectroscopy. I mean, usually what you do is you put it between two huge glass beads, and if you pull, the whole thing will orient exactly in one direction. You can only pull in one direction. But Matthias Rief, actually, he pioneered a system where you can pull with another force to the side, okay? And by doing this triangularization, you can come up with different directions, and I think this would be the way one should also go for the motors. Okay, so this is the three-bit assay by James Buttigieg, and you see that they measure these kind of trajectories. Okay, and you see very nicely the stochasticity in the system, I mean, all the fluctuations. So probably we had 8 models here, probably this was even less models, okay? It's not so well controlled because they do it with the speeds. Now, catch bonding, so what you see here is if I increase the load on the motors, I increase the number of bound motors. Okay, but the point is, it's not only the single mode, it's also an ensemble property, okay? What we're now doing is we're shifting the population inside this ensemble. So we're shifting from one state to the other, basically, okay? So there's a whole backpropagation of this effect, if you wish. So the catch bonding is really complicated here because it mixes the single molecule catch bonding and the ensemble population from the model. And this is data on the muscle. So you see that if you stretch muscle, you have an increase of the number of attached motors. I mean, I should mention that this kind of data, it's not only pure experimental data. There is some data evaluation here. I mean, they also use some kind of modeling for this, I guess. But you see very nicely that it works, and this was also in Tom Duke's paper. Then the one point we were especially after was the critical size for the system to become deterministic, okay? This is usually measured as a duty ratio. So the duty ratio is the percentage of the system which is actually working together, if you wish, okay? And you see that the duty ratio goes to 1, somewhere here around 10 or at 15, you're really on the safe side. So basically what you see is that if you make the system large enough, you sort of get a mean field behavior, okay? But for small systems, you really see the stochastic signature. And this should be very relevant in the cytoskeleton. And you can measure the force-velocity relationship as a function of the ensemble size. You have to be careful how you actually deal with these backward events. This gives you two different force-velocity relationships. But in principle, we now have an analytical solvable model where we can calculate all of this, okay? The point is that for constant force, this is an analytical solution. I mean, we can write down everything of the Ronstadt master equation we were interested in. This is now the linear force. In this case, we cannot do the analytical solution. We have to do computer simulations, but they're very fast because we have this Ronstadt master equation. You see that the system now cannot propagate because as it moves, the force is building up in the back, okay? So it's pulled back, and at some point, it will rupture, Okay, even the catch bonding cannot help here. It will rupture, it fails, and then it has to start again. And this is the kind of trajectories you see in active gels. In active gels, if you look at the, this is Christoph Schmidt's work actually, if you look at the beads, you very often say they are moved for some while and then they snap back. Okay, this shows, first of all, it's an elastic system, because these gels are usually stabilized by crosslinkers. And second, that you have buildup of force, some rupture process, and you go back. And you see the stochastic signature of having very few motors in there. Okay, so let me conclude. I talk about two different aspects of the systems. First, cells push by growing actin networks. So coming back to the question, I mean, there are many models for growing actin networks. It is a huge field in theoretical biophysics. And there's also a huge number of experimental groups working on it, for example, Dan Fletcher from San Francisco, Berkeley. But our model, I think, is in some sense special because we focus on these two different structures, okay? While most of the other models tend to have more or less parallel filaments pushing against the membrane. And we did this work in a time and there was a lot of debate, like Antonio mentioned, there was a lot of debate about what the electron micrographs are actually saying and so on. And I think our message here is in line with this debate that there is a lot of variability, okay? It depends how fast the cell is going, which part of the cell you're looking at, what the structure exactly looks like, okay? It's not only this crisscross or parallel filaments, you can have changes between it. So in some sense, you can say the cells can shift gears. They actually, if they go from one structure to another structure, they change the sort of the power in the system, okay? It's a little bit like shifting gears on a bicycle. You can adapt to the environmental condition in this way. And probably the real system is much less abrupt than our statistical physics model, but there must be these kind of changes. And then the second part, I talked about the other force-generating system, the myosin II minifilaments. I showed you that under increasing force, the ensemble becomes more stable. This is not only the catch behavior as such, it's also the way the ensemble is actually working in our model. And if you think it a little bit, this is really interesting. It makes some link to mechanosensing because it has been shown that cells react very sensitively to stiffness of the environment, and if the environment is stiff, they become very strong, okay? They rigidify themselves, they create more forces and so on, and the motors make exactly this, okay? So a lot of discussion is about the mechanosensing in the adhesions, but the motors in the cytoskeleton can in principle make the same effect, okay? This is something one has to disentangle in some way. Okay, this is it. Thanks for your attention. Any questions left? Wait, that was supposed to.
So, regarding the first part of the talk, is it expected that at intermediate velocity, the middle peak in orientation histogram will be completely absent? There won't be any finite.
Yeah, so this is what our theory says, yeah. Because you, I mean, of course, if you start a computer simulation, there will be sort of initial phase where everything is there, okay? We all start with a random configuration. But then it will go into a steady state, and the steady state it's really low. So I mean, one thing you might wonder about is that we actually have the sequence of three different phases. Okay, now then later I talk only about the intermediate and the low one. So we think that the fast one is just not realistic. Okay, the very fast one, where basically everything goes in this direction. I think the cell also doesn't want it because it's mechanically very unstable. So our interpretation is that the speed limit is, of course, the growth of a single actin filament. And there are some cells like the keratocytes, which are not that far away from the speed limit, okay? But they're never at one, okay? They're always like, I don't know, 70 or 60% maybe. So I think you can cut away all the upper part of the phase diagram because this is unrealistic anyway, okay? And then you're left with the two other structures. And then the intermediate velocity would have, in our theory, hardly no. But this is only in a steady state. Okay. And of course, what we also did is we looked a little bit, I mean, in principle, you can calculate dynamics, okay? But then we focused for all the rest on the steady states.
So also you're using this velocity as control parameters,
yes,
which are in turn, yeah, regulating the,
yeah,
structure of. So in your models, what is setting this V naught? Is,
yeah,
this what is varying it, or what
Very
was
good
it?
Question. So this is actually a very interesting point. So let me put it this way. Most of the other models don't do it this way, okay? Most of the other models, they actually calculate the velocity of holes, okay? But this typically means that you need more details, okay? And we avoid this, okay? So I think we have this nice idea that, what is really essential here is the competition between the different directions and the forward direction. And this actually goes back to a beautiful work by Mali and Borisi and Pina S. They couch it in the language of evolution. They said that there are different populations which compete with each other. It's like an evolutionary problem, okay? And who wins, okay? So I would say that the plus minus 35 wins in this sense, okay? So the point is that we just do the model the other way around, okay? Because you want to focus on this aspect, we do it like you say. We don't calculate any network velocity. The way we do the computer simulation, we have this additional rule which stores filaments at the top, and this sets the network velocity. One thing I would like to point out, however, if you go in the limit of autocatalytic growth, okay, and if you go back to this rate equation I showed you, this is an important point. Where are we? Here. Okay, so if you do not normalize with the total number of filaments, which is the integral over all angles, okay, then all of the terms here would be linear m, okay? And the only way you can get a steady state is by having all the prefactors exactly canceling, okay? And this is the reason why at the beginning when we started to look into this, I mean, there's beautiful work by Anders Carlsen on this, okay? He used the autocatalytic model, and by using this condition, he calculates network velocity, okay? Because if you put all the prefactors to zero, because the network velocity is somewhere in there, you can solve for the network velocity. This is one way to get the network velocity, okay? But then we realized, I mean, we were thinking, wow, this is a very specific way to single out network velocity, okay? And if you do it the way we do, I mean, not putting, I mean, not crossing out this, but having some n here, okay? I mean, whatever reaction order you look at, you can actually solve for n to get a steady state, but you do not determine the network velocity. And we showed that this way you have a whole band of network velocity which are possible, okay? So I think this answers also partly your question. There's a simple way to get a network velocity, but it means that if you go to one extreme case. The way we do it, we are more general.
That's what I'm trying to understand this model. Mm-hmm. So when the filament grows, do you imply that the growth rate is high at the front?
No. It's just constant.
So in the backward, they also grow constant?
That's hard to say, because as I said, I mean, you cannot see a single filament, okay? That's what I'm saying. You can only see the electron microscopy, and then you have to freeze the system. So how do you, I mean, it's really difficult to measure for single filaments, and there might be some regulation here. But the point is, our model is completely focused on orientations, okay? So the whole idea is that you have different vectors pointing in different directions, and how you project them on each other, this is the difference, okay? And we don't look at this. This might be an interesting aspect. And I think then you can combine this with the Brownian-Redshift model and whatever, okay? Then you get this kind of, and then the velocity would go down as the resistance from the membrane increases and things like this. But we didn't do that. But there was one here.
Yeah, this is more, everything's 2D here. And yeah. So how is the chirality of the filament coming into this? Is it a problem or just ignore it? Or?
No, I mean, the point is that at the conference we had this talk by Stefan Grün. And the finding that chirality is important is completely new. I mean, Stefan, I don't think he even has published this, so it's a very, very exciting, very new aspect that the system has some chirality.
Think about it, you would say that the branching, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
You could have a quasi-2D
layer. Yeah. You see, I mean, I would say that the largest unresolved riddle in lamellar polya is why is it two-dimensional?
So how two-dimensional is it actually?
Very two-dimensional.
Very.
It is, you see, the point is that you have to see the cell is like 30 microns across, and the thickness is sometimes 100 nanometer or less, I mean, maybe 200 nanometers at most, okay, at the very edge. So it's really very two-dimensional. If you look at the electron it's again electron microscopy, but it's extremely two-dimensional the way they are arranged. You only have a few layers on top of each other. So it's very two-dimensional. Yeah, it's a very, I mean, you hit the point, okay?
If you assume it's two-dimensional, that sets a scale at which you can branch or not, you know, in minimum scale at least.
The point is that you would expect naively that it branches in all directions, also in the third dimension, okay? But somehow this is not happening, and the reason must be that it's all controlled by the membrane, okay? And the factors which make the branching agent active, they're all at the very tip, okay? And this somehow must do the trick. But it's a very good question. I mean, this is something which has not really been understood yet.
Have you had a chance to look at the size distribution of this actin filament in the microscope analysis?
I mean, you mean the length from the branch
length,
to
length
the...
length distribution of it. Yeah. Slow case and fast case, do you see something?
Yeah, so we... I think we didn't really look at it much. So we did it in the computer simulation,
yeah.
And this has an exponential size distribution because we have a simple Poisson process. Okay, but I'm not sure about the point is that, let me put it this way, okay? We do image processing, but it's not our core business. And the way Julian Weichel did the image processing was to come up with an algorithm which extracts directions. Okay. We didn't actually work on the nodes because this would be a much bigger challenge to identify the next node and to measure the distance from the node to the membrane. And I think there you really have to talk to the experts who are doing this. It's much more complicated. But the simplest result could be a exponential distribution.